Hi, I'm Gary Nall. We're here to talk about ways we can live a longer and healthier and hopefully disease-reduced life. Because what are you facing today? You're facing higher death rates from fentanyl, suicide, alcoholism if you're young, and you're facing more obesity. If you're young, heart disease, arthritis, if you're young, things we never had to experience when I was growing up, but today they're common. And we're not talking about a little percentage of the population, we're talking about a large percent. But then as we age, we also go through a midlife situation. It used to be midlife was about 35. 30 even was midlife at one time in the United States. But today, we are actually reversing our aging timeline. We're living shorter because of COVID and all the choices that happened during COVID. And it's at least 3 years off our lifespan, and in some cases, longer. Because what did people do during the last 3 years? They stayed at home, many of them, and never have figured that out. How is it that a liquor store is essential, and somehow the virus won't infect you in the liquor store? Or if you shop, but if you shop in a box store like Walmart, virus doesn't seem to bother anyone there. But if you shop in a small mom and pop store and shop in a small restaurant, oh yeah, yeah, can't go there. The virus is waiting behind every box. How foolish was that? Well, it was. But I'm not here to talk about the stupidity of bureaucratic minds. I'm talking about making positive choices with reason, because you want to live a longer life. And every choice matters, because it's all cumulative. Good things, good deeds are cumulative. We feel better about ourselves for being a good person and doing the right thing. And we like other people because they touch our heart, not just stimulate our mind. The person in the crowd that tries to be the braggart, that shows off, that has to start and end every conversation, that's a person that's tedious. That's a person we don't like being around. Yet we'll rarely say so. But who do we like being around? People we can laugh with. People that allow us to laugh at ourselves. People we can feel relaxed and at ease with. The people who've got our backs. They're not going to take what we share in our relationships or in our friendships or our family gatherings and share it with the world. No, that breaks our confidence. No, these are people that whatever we do, it's our experience, and that's it. And now trust is a very important issue, because without trust, what are we going to do? Who are we going to do it with? What opportunities will we pass by? Because, gee whiz, I didn't trust I could do that. I didn't trust the people I was working with. No, we have to regain trust. We have to regain optimism. We have to regain the ability to be like a child, curious about everything, and wanting to know as much as we can. That's why I do this research. That's why every night for hours, I'm studying the scientific literature to present to you in lay language information that can allow you to make better choices. Your freedom of choice is going to be directly related to how honest is the information you're receiving, how unbiased is it, and how usable is it. What's the good of talking about something you can't use or you can't afford? So all this goes into making decisions. So we begin, for example, with Tufts and Georgetown universities. They found that L-carnitine, that's C-A-R-N-I-T-I-N-E, can promote muscle growth and strength, especially in older adults. And what are the two things we miss as we grow older, meaning over the age of 40? Muscle mass begins to shrink. Human growth hormone diminishes. Exercise diminishes. Fatigue sets in. The mitochondria, the energy factories of our cells, are depleted for a lot of reasons. Stress will deplete it because stress raises cortisol, epinephrine, norepinephrine, catecholamines. And that is a fight or flight series of responses lasting maybe a minute, 2 minutes. What if you're stressed all day long? What if you can't let go of something? What if you can't get beyond something? What if you're just holding on to anger or revenge like a dog with a bone? Then you end up hurting yourself again. And that's a big deal in the United States. because we have not allowed people to forgive and go on with their lives, learning the lesson so it doesn't happen again, hopefully. So in this process, you exhaust your adrenal glands. Stress exhausts your adrenal glands, where you get your natural adrenaline, and now you're not getting it. So you have your coffee. That'll get me up in the morning. That'll get me moving. Yeah, and it does a lot of damage to your brain and to your circulatory system, and especially creating GERD in the stomach. Where do you think all this digestive reflux comes from? Coffee in the stomach, hydrochloric acid. It's not a combination, it's compatible. And suddenly you're belching back up into the esophagus, causing your hydrochloric acid to burn the sensitive mucus lining of your esophagus. As a result, one of the fastest growing cancers in the world is esophageal cancer. Now you can help that. You can help overcome what we thought was a cause of cancer in the stomach, was E. pylori, Helicobacter. It was actually a bacteria and causing the ulcers in most cases. What do you think helped it? Cabbage juice. Yeah, cabbage juice. I was once working on a series of books that I wrote and called The Secret Circle. They were factually correct but novelized. And I was working with the city editors of the New York Journal America, Guy Richards, famous journalist, kind of like a out of a Damon Runyon movie. And we would meet and go over what really happened to the Romanovs. And there was a whole group of what are called White Russians. White Russians had nothing to do with the color of their skin. They were either the Reds, that were the communists, the Bolsheviks, and the Leninists, and there was the Royalists. The whites were the Royalists. Marie Kropotkin and all these people I got to meet. And they were born in Russia. They were relatives of Tsar Nicholas II, Alexandria. And so, true story. And I wrote a book on this. And there was an interesting thing because no one ever probated the will of the wealthiest man in the world. He owned the Trans-Siberian Railroad. He had gold mines. He was phenomenally wealthy. Why didn't they probate the will? Because his mother was still alive, the Dowager. His brother, Michael, was alive. All these immediate relatives were alive, and therefore they should have had all the wealth. Well, you can't probate a will if the person isn't dead. And they weren't. They escaped. I'm not going to go into any more of it. This, but the man who, there was a whole group of us, Robert Speller Jr., was the most brilliant man on this whole subject. And Peter Bessel from Great Britain, Member of Parliament, all these people were all working together. And I had a piece of that puzzle based upon my own work, a man named Aaron Simonovich, who was Rasputin's personal secretary, controlled his life. And this is something I've never talked about. That was a long time ago, in the early 1970s. In any case, while we're sitting there talking one day, going over, you know, the community up in Bedford, Connecticut, which was the Russian enclave. He bent over. I said, "What's wrong?" He said, "Oh, it's, you know, he's coughing and he's coughing up blood." And I said, "We better get to the hospital." He said, "No, I know what's wrong. I got to take this medicine." He took some medicine. He said, "I've had this for about 2 years now." And I said, "What is it?" He said, "Well, I've got these ulcers." So I said, "Okay." I said, "If you can meet tomorrow, I want to give you something." So I brought him a gallon of raw, organic cabbage juice. And he said, "What's this?" And I said, "It may be able to help you. And here's some herbs that can also help you. Marshmallow root, fennel root, anise root." And so he took them. 3 days later, he said, "Something's happening in there. I haven't coughed up any blood." And a month later, his ulcers were healed. And so there's a lot of things that we can do to help the body in its healing process, but we have to be open to it. And that's a big deal. In fact, I was working in Harlem every day at the Schoenberg and also the County Cullen, and I was working on my book, Actually, three books, Black Geniuses, about all the black inventions, or the inventions made by African Americans, including Louis Latimer, who really should have gotten the credit for the light bulb instead of Edison. But Edison was smart in a sense. He would buy up inventors' inventions and put them to work in his Edison laboratories, but he got the credit for it and the money for it. In any case, I had spent about 2 years finding all these inventions. There were hundreds of inventions, and probably the greatest inventor ever was Booker T. Washington. Very important part of history, as far as I'm concerned. In any case, there was a woman across the table, and she had a really, really bad cold. So I went home at lunchtime, and I made up a bunch of juices, and I filled them with supplements, and I took them out. I says, "Ma'am," I said, "this may help you." "What's in it?" I told her. And she took it. Well, the next day she came in and said, "Well, that worked really good. You know, no more nasal drip, my congestion, my head's cleared up. What are you doing here?" Mind you, we've been working here for 2 weeks at that woman. I had seen her for 2 weeks. And I said, "Well, I'm trying to find people who worked in Hollywood who are African American back at the beginning." She said, "Oh," she said, "my friend worked in Hollywood, and he was called the Black Valentino. His name was Lorenzo Tucker, and his wife is a close friend of mine." Ooh, that door opened. And from there, and you can see photographs on my website under photos, you'll see me sitting with a group of people, and all those are actors who had once worked for Oscar Michelou, the great independent black producer, and there was Lorenzo Tucker. And then we worked together, and that's how I met Brock Peters, who became a friend. And after several years, I published Black Hollywood, History of the African-American Experience in Films. Small world, isn't it? All these interconnections. Sometimes I feel like Forrest Gump without the chocolate. I seem to have had all these wonderful experiences. That's because I approach everything like a child. You know, the innocence of, wow, let's find this. What's in there? In any case, and that also is what drew me into health. But let's go back to this point about, sometimes when I'm talking extemporaneously, I just see these little sidebar issues coming in. But supplementing with L-carnitine can increase your lean muscle mass, and that's what we're losing, as I mentioned. And this only took 8 weeks. 8 weeks of using L-carnitine and L-leucine, L-E-U-C-I-N-E, and creatine, C-R-E-A-T-I-N-E, and vitamin D3. Just those things. And most runners use them. Most people exercising don't know about them. And they're all good. No problems with them. And you suddenly cause muscle cells to increase protein synthesis. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Nutrition and Metabolism. So that's good news, because L-carnitine does something else also. If you're having fatigue, brain fog, dementia, Alzheimer's, I'm going to recommend L-carnitine. If you want to make sure you have a strong heart and you don't have a heart attack before you go to bed at night, you take L-carnitine, vitamin E, cayenne, and magnesium, and it helps your heart, and it thins your blood, preventing strokes. A lot of people have strokes in the middle of the night. And also when you go out for a workout, if you take coenzyme Q10 and L-carnitine, magnesium and calcium, and vitamin E and tocotrienols and cayenne, that helps you, because carnitine also gives energy to the heart. It feeds the metabolism of the heart, what are called the mitochondria, but it also does the same in the brain. So if I'm going to go do a lecture, and I know some of my lectures, those of you who've been to them, they go on and on, I take about 1,000 milligrams of L-carnitine because it energizes the mitochondria in my brain. If I'm going to do a race, I'm going to take L-carnitine because it helps my heart muscle, and yours as well. So, you know, this is what they found at Georgetown University Medical Center and Tufts University. So something simple, something natural. L-carnitine in combination improves protein anabolism and increases muscle mass and functioning strength. the things we lose. As we age 50, you lose 1-2% of your muscle each year. And that's why you should take a plant-based protein in a smoothie in the morning. Take about 1/3 of what you need at a time. So you take 1/3 in the morning. For most people, it's 20 grams. Might be more or less, depending upon your body size and your activity and how much muscle you actually use. But that's a good range. So if I take one scoop of protein powder and I throw it into a blender in the morning, and I can put my berries in and a scoop of, you know, a scoop of walnuts or walnut butter one day, and the next day I might go to cashews, the next day hazelnuts, the next day almonds. I rotate. The key is rotating them. And then throw different berries in each day. You're really starting the day right. I mean, you're treating your body as if you were a finely tuned living organism. You're giving it all that it needs. And that's good. Lots of fiber. Lots of raw in the diet, too. That helps. Avocado, an avocado a day keeps a heart attack away because the oils in the avocado are great for the heart. In any case, by the age of 60, you're losing 3% of your muscle mass per year. That's huge, and that's why we see people kind of dwindling down. And that's when I'm offering 1,500 milligrams of L-carnitine and 2,000 milligrams of leucine and 3,000 milligrams of creatine and probably 4,000 units of vitamin D3. That would be, you know, anywhere from 10 micrograms of vitamin D3, but units are easier to understand. Then you're going to have muscle mass. And this was done against a placebo, and it worked. So you want to keep your muscles because you want to keep your strength and you want to keep your physical activity, and this allows it. That alone would help an awful lot of people in this audience. Now, another thing that we have problems with is fatigue, especially chronic fatigue syndrome. It's associated with distinct changes in the microbiome, the bacteria in your gut. Columbia University did this study along with Jackson Laboratory. So over the past 3 years, the emergence of long-term effects associated with COVID-19 has led to increased focus on a disease with similar hallmarks and symptoms, and that is chronic fatigue syndrome. And two studies published in the journal Cell, Host and Microbe, are taking a closer look as it relates to the microbiome. And what they're finding is that the quality of your gut bacteria, in both cases, can make a difference when it comes to the outcome of your fatigue, either from long COVID or from chronic fatigue syndrome. And both of these will impact your immune system. Example, clean, healthy food, healthy bacteria. Processed, overprocessed, denatured food and beverages, sugar, fat, trans fats, unhealthy bacteria. And unhealthy bacteria, unhealthy immune system. Healthy bacteria, healthy immune system. There's a definite correlation. So we want to make sure that we're getting good, healthy bacteria. Probiotics and prebiotics and foods or supplements does that. A lot of people are going towards the vegan dairy, you know, like a yogurt made from coconut. Okay, where do you find on there the amount of bacteria you're getting? I haven't seen any. Why? Because they're not giving you enough of the bacteria. You want to know, how much bacteria am I getting? Am I getting a billion? Am I getting 10 billion? Yeah, then you're making a big difference. Also, from Pennsylvania State University comes a study that 150 minutes of aerobic exercise per week reduces liver fat. Ah, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, it's a major killer. And a huge percentage of the American population suffers from it. So you're not having a diseased liver because of alcohol. That's why it's called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, because your diet, fructose, sugars, saturated fats, trans fats. And once you get obese, you're going to have that kind of condition more often than not. But they're suggesting 150 minutes. That's not much. That's 2.5 hours a week I suggest 400 minutes a week. 400 minutes a week. That's 45 minutes a day. All right? That would do even better than the small amount they're suggesting. But still, it's helping people. And helping people is the key. Sometimes you have to start at a lower amount and work up, and that's fine. And finally, red rice bran extract alleviates a high-fat, diet-induced, non-alcoholic liver disease. And this is in the University of School of Medicine in Thailand. And you've seen it in a health food store. You've seen red rice bran extract, or RRBE. It's rich in phytonutrients and has been shown to have anti-diabetic, anti-inflammatory, and antioxidant properties. It also is anti-hepatic steatosis, and it really makes a difference in helping your liver. So something is all natural, non-toxic, that can help you if you have non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. So now combine the two. Combine the exercise, that is proven beneficial, and combine this in the diet, and you have a chance to maintain hepatic health. Yeah. That's the latest on health and nutrition. By the way, one last thing from Capital Medical University in China. Alzheimer's healthy lifestyle is linked to slower memory decline regardless of genetic risk. Okay? So let's just keep to a healthy lifestyle. They studied 29,000 older adults and over 10 years to investigate the link between lifestyle choices and memory loss. And that's what they found. So, healthier lifestyle, less inflammation in the brain, better neurological activity, better cognition, better memory, better skills at thinking, resolving problems. So the fruits, the vegetables, the whole grains, the legumes, nuts, the seeds, the pulses, the green tea, healthy juices, that's what can help you. That's the latest on health and healing. And go to GaryNall.com, read the articles, see the videos. Also, for a lot of our work here, especially the series that I do every day called Classroom on the Air, and it can go from 20 minutes to an hour. I select a different topic every day, and I go into depth on just one topic. Today, it's about what you should know about artificial intelligence and its different manifestations, and how by not knowing, you could be jeopardizing your own future, because it's going to be a tsunami of destroying jobs. And yet, over 100 million people in the first 2 months signed up for it. Wow. No thinking. Just this mindset of, yeah, if I don't have to figure something out, if I don't have to do any research, and I just ask a question that gives me the answer instantly within like 3 seconds, yeah, that's what I want. Well, think deeper, because there's a price that all of us are going to pay. But anyhow, you can go to Rumble, you can go to Odyssey, you can go to YouTube, Gary Noll YouTube, and you can get that. And that's a free service. All right? Back in a moment. Please stay with us. My guest has a lot to say on a topic that is rarely discussed with his form of authority. He is Dr. Andrew Huff. He is a former vice president and senior scientist with Echo Health Alliance, which has captured headlines in the non-mainstream alternative media as the nonprofit research organization with deep ties to the federal health agencies, the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, Anthony Fauci, and the Wuhan Biolabs engaged in gain-of-function studies. Having witnessed firsthand, not hearsay, the dangerous activities Echo Health Alliance was conducting, he turned whistleblower. He's a military veteran. Earlier, he worked with the Sanda National Laboratories as a technical scientist, a cancer initiative out of the University of Minnesota, public health work at Michigan State University, and other government and industry positions. Andrew's also the author of a new book just released. I highly recommend it. The Truth About Wuhan, How I Uncovered the Biggest Lie in History, which recounts his personal experience at the heart of the lab's origin of the COVID-19 virus and the various players involved with orchestrating the pandemic. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You write that the development and engineering of the SARS-2 virus by Echo Health Alliance, the Wuhan Institute of Virology in China, and the University of North Carolina is the most sophisticated bioengineering endeavor known to humankind. These are the primary organizational entities that get mentioned by those holding to the view of lab origins. But there are others, including various funders, such as USAID, the military entity DARPA, University of California, Davis, a company called MetaBiota, and others. And if I'm to understand correctly, gain-of-function research was already underway before Fauci got involved. I think it might be best for you to first speak about the origins of this gain-of-function research into coronaviruses. When did this research begin? At whose behest? And what were the primary motivations for conducting this research in the beginning? And bring us up to date about the connections between Echo Health Alliance and Wuhan. And thirdly, you left Echo Health in 2016, 4 years before the pandemic. However, you already noted serious ethical concerns then. So please share that with us as well. One final notion. Just yesterday, I watched a clip from a small conference that was not open to the general public, in which Moderna's top officer stated that as of 2019, they already had 100,000 vaccines produced, and he was speaking with a lab person, can we do 1 billion next year? Unless I'm missing something, in 2019, we weren't even aware that there was a problem with the COVID virus. The World Health Organization had not even designated it. And to have 100,000 vaccines already produced, you had to have development, research, clinical studies. That takes years. That meant that these people were working on a vaccine for a virus that we were not made aware of even existed long before it became public knowledge. What I'm missing here, I don't know. Maybe you can fill us in on, is it just a coincidence? How did they know to need 100,000 vaccines and then speculate before we even had any public knowledge or official announcements that we were going to have a lot of people vaccinated? The forum is yours. Take your time.
Wow, you covered a lot of territory there, and I'll try to unpack it. So I think I'll start with the vaccine production and what we know about when SARS-CoV-2, the infectious disease agent known as COVID, emerged. So first, the first samples that were collected and analyzed actually were detected in Italy, and this is much after the infectious disease outbreak occurred. So what happened was a number of people went and gave blood donations, and blood donations serve as a historical record for epidemiologists like myself, because once the blood is donated and stored, you can sort of go back in time and look and see what was circulating. And it's an old trick among epidemiologists, actually. Well, a number of scientists in Europe, when analyzed this historical record of blood donations, and found that SARS-CoV-2, I think my dog just opened up the door. Sorry about that. SARS-CoV-2 emerged in September or October of 2019. So let's think about that. So this is all in hindsight and after the fact. So the next thing that we know is that after this emerging infectious disease started to spread around the planet, the Wuhan Institute of Virology started to panic buy laboratory containment equipment to plug the leak. So the Chinese were aware that there was a leak occurring at their laboratory, and there are documents to prove that they were trying to plug the leak. The next thing that happens in this timeline is that it looks like the U.S. government and the Chinese start coordinating the pandemic response, the narrative, the psychological operation, which is launched against the world population. So basically, the United States government, the Chinese government start working together. And this is where my personal history comes into play. So I used to actually help the three-letter agencies develop biosurveillance tools. Biosurveillance is defined as the ability to detect or identify emerging infectious diseases so you can identify and select which policies are the best way to respond to infectious disease outbreaks. Well, this technology is so great, I actually accurately predicted the emergence of Zika virus in the United States. A lot of times it uses sophisticated computing equipment, high-performance computing, supercomputing, artificial intelligence, which is actually machine learning, but everyone uses the term artificial intelligence, to predict and detect these things. And you can almost do it in near real time. So when the U.S. government loads this onto their secret computer systems, they have access to the pipeline of information. So it's basically a fast way to sift through these systems and identify when these infectious disease outbreaks. And I know that the Department of Defense, the Department of Homeland Security, the CDC, the FDA, and other agencies have these kind of tools because I developed them. So that leads me to believe that they found out early about this if they weren't directly notified by the Chinese pretty early on. So probably in September or October. The other interesting thing that happens is that I'm contacted by a program officer at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. That's a sub-agency of the Department of Defense that does the most advanced scientific research in the world. And they offer me a position, a dream, which would have been my dream job, the dream job for many national security scientists, in late September, early October of 2019. What's so strange about this is that I'm actually contacted on a cell phone, which is brand new. Nobody in my old national security network has the phone number. And Dr. Amy Jenkins from DARPA gets a hold of me and gives me the hard press to accept this position. And I couldn't figure out why she was, you know, being so persistent that I take this position in October of 2019. And I was working as a biotech executive in San Francisco. So I didn't want to move to the East Coast. I didn't want to have to get a top secret security clearance again. I was trying to get away from the Department of Defense and national security work for a number of years. I just wanted to work on biotechnology. Well, I passed on the offer. And then the next thing that happens, there's the World Military Games in Wuhan. And what happens with these World Military Games is that athletes from all over the world, from militaries, go to compete against each other in Wuhan, and they all report that the city is locked down. There's nobody on the streets. The Chinese are wearing Hyvex suits. And with these Hyvex suits, they're taking temperatures of all the athletes. The games go on, and then after after the games are finished, a number of the athletes report coming down with pneumonia-like illness from participating in these games. And this is now late October 2019. Well, then you fast forward to the point where you're getting at, where you're talking about these vaccines. There's a document which shows there's a material transfer agreement from Dr. Ralph Barrick's laboratory. He's the scientist working at the laboratory at the University of North Carolina, to Moderna to begin manufacturing of the SARS-CoV-2 mRNA vaccine. Well, it's technically not a vaccine even by definition, and Moderna and Baxter and Pfizer's own admission, it's actually a gene therapy, but it goes into production in late 2019.
Take us further.
Okay. So with that, so just at the context there of what factually happened, and there's documents to prove all of that. Now, where this starts to get really strange is what happens before that. And so going back to my time at EcoHealth Alliance, so I worked at EcoHealth Alliance from 2014 to 2016. I was hired as a senior scientist. And due to my success, I was promoted to vice president after about a year. And that's very fast for upward progression. I received about $6 million within my first year from the Department of Defense, from the Defense Threat Reduction Agency, to develop many of these biosurveillance platforms. And when I was promoted to vice president, I asked to be included in the other projects at EcoHealth Alliance. And the big project at EcoHealth Alliance was funded by the United States Agency for International Development, which I jokingly call CIA Lite, which I'll get to in a second, to go around the planet and collect infectious disease samples and conduct biosurveillance, specifically looking with a high priority for coronaviruses. And, you know, I thought it was the coolest thing in the world to be working on this project. You sort of serve as a diplomat because you were a scientific diplomat because you actually work with the high level government officials from multiple government countries. You work with the embassy, the mission staff. And then you would go, we'd go collect these samples primarily from bats. There were other diseases we look for, but the main emphasis was coronaviruses. Well, another interesting thing happens when I first start working at Eco Alliance is that I'm asked to review a proposal which was submitted to the National Institute of Health called Understanding the Risk of Bat Coronavirus Emergence. So this is the gain of function proposal, which was funded by Dr. Anthony Fauci at the National Institute of Health, the National Institute for Allergens and Infectious Diseases, a sub-agency of NIH. I don't know why I was asked to review the proposal. I have the original copy in my possession. I've already posted and released it to social media along with all of my other documents to prove what I'm saying. So without a doubt, this was clearly gain of function work. And in that proposal, they actually state that the gain of function work began under the USAID PREDICT program. And this is very common because typically to receive large contracts and grants, you have to have preliminary data and demonstrate a key word in government contracting called performance. And to do that, you have to show that you have established relationships with the investigators, that you and you have a high probability of success. And the only way to do that is actually to begin the work before you're awarded the money. And this happens all the time in scientific research. It's how the best scientists in the world actually get funding. My wife is also a scientist and she's a professor. I think she's about 2 years ahead of her funding. And when I was still working in academia, I tried to always be 1 to 2 years ahead of my funding. And this was the normal business practice while I worked at EcoHealth Alliance. So there's a pattern here. If you always do the work before you ask for the money, because then it guarantees, almost guarantees that you'll receive the grant money or the contract money, depending which one you're applying for. So all the relationships to do the gain of function work at the Wuhan Institute of Virology were formed under this USAID PREDICT program. So there's another of other interesting things that happened while I work at EcoHealth Alliance. So Dr. Peter Daszak, who is the CEO and president of EcoHealth Alliance, who is my boss, my direct supervisor, came and asked me for a number of things when I was working there. So he asked me to help put together a collaborator report. A collaborator report is a formal report or document that scientists usually have to send off to government program managers to demonstrate that you're executing work on a contract. The interesting aspect of this, though, is this particular collaborator report was for the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Agency, IARPA. It's a sub-agency of what's called the Office of Director of National Intelligence, which is like the hub for all of the intelligence community. I have no clue why Dr. Daszak asked me to prepare this collaborator report, but he was my boss and I wanted to get off my plate and I had other more important things to do. So I completed the collaborator report, gave it off to Dr. Daszak and never heard anything again. What's interesting here is once I'm promoted to vice president and I'm sitting in the weekly financial meetings, there was no funding from IARPA on the books, which suggests that there was some other contract mechanism or there was possibly dark money, money off the books going to the government from the intelligence community to EcoHealth Alliance. Another strange thing happened while I worked there. So Dr. Peter Daszak came and asked me to help him build a pitch deck, an investment pitch deck. The investment pitch deck was to be presented to InQtel. InQtel is the CIA's venture capital firm. Not many people realize that the CIA and Department of Defense have a venture capital firm, but they do. It's called InQtel, and they've quite famously invested in Google Earth, or the company that created Google Earth, and which Google acquired. So there, if you go look at the portfolio companies that InQtel has invested to, they've actually invested in a lot of the leading technology companies. And we are presenting to InQtel the humanized collecting coronavirus samples internationally to do humanized mice gain of function work to make medical countermeasures, aka vaccines. The other strange thing that happens while I work at EcoHealth Alliance, and this will be the last strange one to bring up, there were many other strange things that happened while I worked there once I was promoted, was that Dr. Peter Daszak approached me in late 2015, late at night at work, and asked me, "Hey, Andrew, do you mind if I ask you a question?" I go, "Sure, Peter, go ahead." Well, someone from the CIA approached me, and they're interested in the places we're working, the data we're collecting, and the people we're working with. Do you think it's a good idea that we should work with them? And I said, Peter, it never hurts to talk to them. There could be money. And I was actually shocked that he was asking me this question, since I came from this world before EcoWealth Alliance. And, you know, I probably didn't ask enough good questions before I started EcoWealth Alliance, or enough probing questions, because I was trying to get away from the defense work. And once I was hired at EcoWealth Alliance, I realized that I was being leveraged with my national security and past defense experience to actually expand the portfolio of defense type and national security type work at the company. And when he asked, when Peter asked me whether or not we should work with the CIA, maybe the company was already working with the CIA and he was just trying to see how I'd react to it. I don't know, but I mean, this is why Congress should launch a full investigation into this, and I can come to the back to that too. The other interesting thing about this venture capital firm InQtel is that it heavily invested into a company known as Metabiota. So Metabiota is one of our partner companies on the PREDICT program, with along with the University of California, Davis. And Metabiota received a large investment from InQtel. The funny thing is, when Hunter Biden's laptop emails are released, I went and searched for InQtel or EcoWealth to see if it turned up. And yes, it looks like that Hunter Biden was involved with a number of other state bureaucrats and people who were political to help Metabiota receive the InQtel investment, or they were talking about it. So this is a very crazy world we live in. And the other thing about Metabiota, and where people might have heard of it before, Metabiota was the company that was responsible for the contracts with the Defense Threat Reduction Agency for the biolaboratories in Ukraine. So all this stuff is so crazy, but you can't make it up. All this is easily provable with, you know, internet searches and the documents that are out there. So at the end of the day, what this all appears like to me is that this was, you know, one giant intelligence collection operation and defense operation gone wrong, both in terms of the mRNA vaccine development and also the development of the agent. Because what's important to know about biodefense is that anytime that you're trying to make a what's called a medical countermeasure, aka a vaccine, at least sometimes a vaccine, is that you have to do the research on the agent in parallel to developing the vaccine. They go hand in hand. So they call this dual use research. And if it's on a select agent, and select agent is a government term to mean dangerous infectious diseases, like SARS coronavirus is the first one. If you're doing gain of function work on SARS coronaviruses, it is this dual use research concern, meaning it can be weaponized. And it's a gray area with international law. All the different countries around the world are doing it, including the United States. And oftentimes it's happening at universities all over the country. It's going on happening right now at this moment at a number of universities. And what that means is, when you're doing gain of function work, is that you're trying to enhance the virulence, the pathogenicity, the transmissibility, the infectivity, and I can just, you know, make that even state that in simpler terms. You're trying to make the agent more harmful to humans in some way. And that's the exact kind of work which was happening at EcoHealth Alliance. Now, through the partners at, like Dr. Ian Lipkin at Columbia University, Dr. Ralph Barrick at the University of North Carolina, they had a lot of the other relationships back with the National Institute of Health and the pharmaceutical companies that would then use that genetic material collected at EcoHealth Alliance to do the medical countermeasure development. And that appears to be exactly what happened with the emergence of SARS-CoV-2. And, you know, then there's the whole crazy story about what happens after the disease emergence. But I think that sums it up pretty well in a nutshell.
Thank you, Andrew. Now, some specific issues. Could you say with any certainty that this was absolutely made in a laboratory, did not come naturally from nature, as we've been told? And why is it, in your opinion, that no Department of Justice, or FBI, or World Health Organization has sought to see who is responsible and what was their original intent? Was it to make a a weapon that could counter the virus's effect, or was it, as some believe, in part due to the Department of Defense of the Chinese Communist Party, who also had 100 scientists with PhDs in virology working at Wuhan purely for biological reasons? And how would that turn the scenario if we were to learn, oh yeah, this was originally funded as a biological weapons agent, and that's why it was kept so secret, that's why the Communist Party has not cooperated, and that's why everybody's been in denial? Or even if it was just gain-of-function research to help thwart a pandemic or serious outbreak, they lied about everything because they clearly knew, because under Freedom of Information Act and whistleblowers and yourself, we've seen the documentation of people who said that they all knew what was going on. There are just too many people participating in it. They've been closed-lipped up until now because they haven't been held accountable under any congressional hearing. They haven't had all their records, phone records, et cetera, subpoenaed. That probably will happen. If that is the case, then Luc Montagnier and the scientists at the Institute of Pasteur would be correct in saying that this genomic anomalies in the virus sequence can only be explained with genetic engineering. And how likely is it that Anthony Fauci and Bill Gates were implicated in supporting and covering up coronavirus gain-of-function research? Or are there others who we need to be putting our attention upon?
Well, the first part of your question, so without a doubt, this is human engineering. There's actually no evidence that this naturally emerged. And all the data that were handed to us by the Chinese, we can prove was a fabrication. It was a lie based on the fact that those serum and serology samples were found in Europe and analyzed in September, October 2019. So the epidemiology first proves that the narrative that has been communicated to the world is false. So that should raise red flags. Always follow the epidemiology. I was actually trained as a FBI criminal epidemiologic investigator. So you follow it back and you see when the first cases are. And so the narrative is not true. So the next question is, well, where did the agent come from? So the genetic sequence of the agent itself has characteristic hallmark signatures of engineering, and it has HIV inserts, which were discussed in a number of publications from Shi Zhengli and Dr. Barrick, and were proven by actually analyzing the genetic sequence of the agent against this a National Institute of Health database. One's called GenBank, and the tool to do it is called BLAST. And so the probability that the genetic characteristics of four different aspects of the sequence emerge naturally are one in the trillions. So, and if you look at the actual agents, okay, the infectious disease agents and the species that are the hosts or the reservoirs for them, these animals and species typically do not come into contact in the wild, nor do they result in zoonotic disease transmission, like HIV, for example. It's primarily chimps and humans as a reservoir. And those are slightly different types, even in that, between chimps and humans. So, without a doubt, this is an engineered bug. And so the question is, well, why the big cover up and why the big secrecy? Well, from what I speculate and what I hypothesize is that the advanced biotechnology was actually given to the Chinese in a trade. So here we have my old boss telling me that he was working with the CIA. We were involved in all these sort of quasi intelligence activities at EcoHealth Alliance. And, you know, I asked the question to myself, I started thinking about, I'm like, you know, why were we doing this work in China? I even asked it in an executive meeting because I was worried that the Chinese were going to steal our intellectual property. I actually asked the question, looking out for the company. And, you know, I didn't really get a good answer back then. And it didn't really make sense to me this day, because the Wuhan Institute of Virology had been known by people in the biosecurity, biosafety community, and national security and weapons and biodefense as the Chinese Communist Party, Chinese military's bioweapons laboratory. So here, EcoHealth Alliance is doing work with that. And I thought that was strange when I worked at EcoHealth Alliance. And here's a fun question that I'd like to ask you real quick. Do you think that the Chinese need $400,000 of U.S. money to do infectious disease research?
No.
Okay. The next question is, do you think they need $10 million of U.S. funding to do infectious disease research?
They don't need $100 million.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I went through that logical thought process myself. And then I asked myself, well, what were the Chinese...
If we fund it for any amount, we're suddenly attached to it.
Yes. Well, and here's the interesting part. So I asked myself, well, what was each party getting on this? What was the United States getting on this? And what were the Chinese getting on this? Well, since we knew that it was their bioweapons laboratory, what the Americans were hoping to get this was to collect intelligence on the Wuhan Institute of Virology to see what they were up to in their laboratory. And the what's shocking is that Dr. Anthony Fauci actually admitted this in an interview, that they were trying to see what was going on in the Wuhan Institute of Virology. So why would Dr. Anthony Fauci, who's a sub-agency director at the National Institute of Health, care for 2 seconds, 1 second, what's going on at the Wuhan Institute of Virology? Is the weirdest statement ever. And it's actually when I was making progress on my investigation and was going up, he came out and made the public statement. I actually thought I was driving the narrative shifts coming out of the White House and out of NIH. I mean, you just can't make this stuff up. So he comes out and says this. And you ask yourself, well, what were the Chinese actually getting out of this then? So here they are letting Westerners and Americans into their bioweapons laboratory. Well, the Chinese were about 10 years behind the United States in terms of this advanced biotechnology. And here we have Dr. Ralph Baric and Dr. Ian Lipkin, who are sort of leading the charge in both virus isolation and epidemiology, and then also this genetic engineering work. We traded that advanced biotechnology to the Chinese for access to their laboratories so we could see what was going on, and the whole thing blew up in our face. I think that's what happens.
Do you believe it was accidentally released or intentionally released?
I believe it was accidental, based on the fact that the Chinese were trying to contain and plug the leak. And I think the leak actually went on for a series of time. It just wasn't like one time, one instance. I think the leak was actually probably going on for maybe a month or a few weeks. And then they figured out and they're trying to plug it. So it was probably this kind of continuous event. They weren't really aware. And then they find out something's going on and then they're trying to plug it. But maybe they keep working at the same time, but who knows? This is why there needs to be a formal investigation, but I haven't seen any evidence to suggest that this was intentional. And I'm still open to the possibility that it is. And I discuss this in detail in my book. I don't think anyone would have had the motivation, including the Chinese, to release this agent in their own country. What I suspect what happens is that everybody takes advantage of the situation. So the Bill Gates of the world, the World Economic Foundation types, large corporations, governments, pharmaceutical industry, they all have private intelligence operations much like akin to the government. So they probably find out about this. Just like I would have found out if I would have been still working in the government with the kind of tools that I used to develop. And then they all started preparing for what they wanted to happen, setting the narrative and getting ready to capitalize on it.
Andrew, my final question is relatively straightforward. Do you believe at this moment we have enough evidence between yourself as a whistleblower, scientist, professor, someone who was in the belly of the beast for a number of years, and others who've come forward, information we've retrieved under Freedom of Information Act, to show how this originated and hold those people in these different agencies and universities responsible? Do you think that is possible at this time?
I think it's absolutely possible. And an interesting series of events happened just within the last 2 weeks. Last week, I was contacted actually by the Russian Federation, formally by letter, requesting my assistance to investigate the origin of COVID in the biolaboratories in Ukraine. I was flattered, but I had to respectfully decline because that could be construed as treason. And I actually notified the FBI and other three-letter agencies that had been contacted by a foreign government because they used to hold a top secret clearance in this area. As a result of that, I put that on social media. I've been invited to testify in front of the House of Representatives COVID subcommittee and have been invited to assist with the investigation. With me on that committee helping them, I believe that we'll be able to show the world that there's enough evidence to prosecute and hold these people accountable.
That's terrific because, as you well know, they have now found multiple bio labs, first acknowledged a kind of as an off comment by Victoria Nuland, that, yeah, we have over 23 or whatever the number was, And I'm thinking, why in the world would the United States government put bioweapons labs into the most dangerous country, the most corrupt country in Europe? Makes no sense. But they wanted it right up there near Russia. I'm assuming, and I don't have any evidence to this, that they were doing it because they intended at some point to use those weapons, if need be, against the Russians. Your thoughts on this? I realize it's purely speculative.
Well, actually, I used to be involved with the Department of Defense Defense Threat Reduction Agency in these type programs. And so from the documents that I've seen leaked, I have not seen any evidence of nefarious gain-of-function weapons type research. What I have seen in the documents are were contracts to conduct biosurveillance work. So in legitimate biosurveillance work, looking for infectious diseases from ticks or arthropods, that kind of thing. And so this, the name of the program is, this specific program, their goal is to protect the military force, the U.S. military. So they want to protect the military from chemical, biological, radiological weapons. And that's DITRA's mission. And the CBEP program, called the Cooperative Biological Engagement Program, and actually helped co-write some of these proposals where I worked at Eco Alliance, partners with these laboratories under this logic. And this was part of the Nunn-Lugar Act. The idea is that when the Soviet Union was falling apart, and all the different Soviet republics were splintering off, becoming their own countries, that the United States was worried that weapons of mass destruction would fall into enemy hands or it would go on the loose. So the idea was, or the logic was, that they wanted U.S. government scientists to partner with these foreign laboratories so that we could help build collaborative relationships, strong relationships, collect intelligence on these laboratories so that they were aligned with Western interests and not back with their own crazy interests in their country, maybe, or perhaps or back to Russia. So this was sort of a turf war, and this was a way to get them aligned with the United States. Now, there are a number of people claiming that these Ukrainian biolabs were up to nefarious things. I just haven't seen the proof of it yet. I mean, so if the documents come forward, it's obvious that they were doing weapons development, dangerous gain of function work, trying to weaponize something. I'm open to that.
Okay. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Andrew Huff, former vice president, senior scientist with Echo Health Alliance, now a whistleblower. And a must read is The Truth About Wuhan, How I Uncovered the Biggest Lie in History. And I might mention the greatest consequence to human health in history. Think of all the people who've died who didn't have to. Think of all the people who were good enough with natural immunity, but then told to vaccinate. It's just one compounding error after another. At the very least, a lot of this is going to be brought before the American public, the world community, in the near future. Thank you for being with us, and thank you for being out there.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for watching and listening, and have a nice day.